All right, so what we're going to be learning about today, what Jacob is going to be teaching us today, is how to deal with problem situations that you yourself have created. Basically, from chapter 28 to this chapter, Jacob has been running from a bad situation that he created through his deception and through his deceivery and through everything that's wrong with him as a person. He deceived his brother twice to steal the birthright from him, his older brother. And he deceived his dad, his dad who was going blind. He tricked his blind father into giving him the birthright. And out of fear of what he had done and out of shame of what he had done, he ran away. He fled to his uncle Laban. While he was with his uncle Laban, he continued to make bad decisions, kind of ruining his family dynamic. At this point, he has two wives, both of them are sisters. And he's got two concubines on top of that, He's rolling deep, you know, and he's got a lot of family problems going on within that dynamic. And his uncle has been taking advantage of him over and over again. And he has spent the last 20 years there getting taken advantage of. And so in chapter 31, he's getting a little tired of it. And in chapter 31, if you start in verse 1, he says this: "Now Jacob heard the words of Laban's son, saying, 'Jacob has taken away all that our father's, all that was our father's, and from what was our father's, he has acquired all his wealth.' And Jacob saw the countenance of Laban, and indeed it was not favorable towards him as before. Then the Lord said to Jacob, 'Return to the land of your fathers and to your family, and I will be with you.'" So not only is he kind of a little bit sour towards this whole situation, but we find out through this whole section, I'm not going to read it to you guys, but through when he's going to talk to his wives, what we're going to see is that every single time Laban tried to take advantage of Jacob, God turned the tables on Laban. So whenever Laban tried to steal money from Jacob, God actually gave that money right back to Jacob. And so Jacob's getting sick of being taken advantage of, and Laban is getting sick of having his plans being thwarted. So they're both like just sick of each other. And Laban's like honestly wanting to kill him at this point. And so Jacob finally is at the place where he has no choice. He has nowhere else to go. He has to go back to the bad family situation that he left. And the reason why he doesn't want to go there is because he just doesn't want to deal with it, which is very obvious. And what's going to end up happening is things, I guess, are so bad that he ends up just taking his wives and they end up fleeing in the night from his uncle. The uncle actually catches up with him. And right before he murders Jacob, the uncle gets a dream from God where God says to him, "You better not touch Jacob or I'll kill you." And so Laban catches up with him and he says, "Hey man, like I would kill you, but your God said that he was going to kill me, so I'm not going to do that." And they kind of break bread, and they talk for a little bit. And at the end of the day, if you go to the end of the chapter, what ends up happening is Laban ends up going back home, and Jacob ends up going towards his home, and they set up a pile of rocks as like a witness between the two of them. And basically what they're saying to each other is, "I can't trust you, and you certainly can't trust me, but we're going to let God judge between us." And now that leads us to chapter 32. Where Esau, the older brother of Jacob, is about ready to meet him. Now, the last time that we saw Esau, he was literally comforting himself with the thoughts of murdering his younger brother. So he was sitting at home just fantasizing about just gutting Jacob like a fish. And now that's the situation that Jacob is coming into. So if you pick things up in chapter 32, verse 1, it says this: "So Jacob went on his way, and the angels of God met him. When Jacob saw them, he said, 'This is God's camp.' And he called the name of the place Mahanaim. Then Jacob sent messengers before him to Esau, his brother, in the land of Seir, the country of Edom. And he commanded them, saying, 'Speak thus to my lord Esau. Thus your servant Jacob says, I have dwelt with Laban and have stayed there until now. I have oxen, donkeys, flocks, and male and female servants. And I have sent to tell my lord that I may find favor in his sight.' Then the messengers returned to Jacob, saying, 'We came to your brother Esau, and he is also coming to meet you. And 400 men are with him.'" So what do you think Jacob's thinking at this point? He's like, "Yeah, I'm going to go meet my brother." And someone comes back to him and he says, "Your brother's coming and he's got 400 dudes with him." What would the assumption be? Why has he got 400 guys with him? He's going to massacre him, right? That's the only thought process. Why else would he have 400 guys with him but to just completely wreck his house, you know, and take everything that belonged to him? That's how it was. Back in this culture, you know, you'd have raiding parties and you'd go out and you'd steal, very much like Tatooine in Star Wars. You know, you just had the sand people and they would go and raid people and Sorry if that reference didn't land for you guys. But, you know, it was just very, you know, ghetto there, and they used to do things like that. So Jacob begins to panic. And this is why he's panicking. This is going to be for all of us. All of us are going to have to do this at some point. Well, I mean, you don't have to do this. You could run away from your problems your entire life. At some point, you and I are going to make decisions that are going to so ruin a relationship that your only option is going to be to flee. And at some point, God, if you belong to Him, is going to get you to a place where you're going to have to confront people you've wronged. And it's going to be uncomfortable, and it's going to be something that you don't want to do. So many people in our generation, what they've done, when I went to the Marines, so many people that were in the Marines with me, one of the major reasons they were in the Marines is because they were running away from a bad situation. They had done something in their high school or in their college, something was happening in their family, something like that was going on, and they're just like, I need to get away from this situation. And so they didn't know how to confront their problem, so they fled. And that's going to be what you guys are going to do. I can almost guarantee you that you guys, as you're listening to this story, you can think of situations and scenarios in your life that this has already happened. You don't necessarily have to flee across the country like me and my friends did, but you can flee to a different set of group of people. You can cut off relationships with people and refuse to talk to them. There are so many different ways that you can handle the situation, but the question is, are you running from your problems? Well, then you could relate to Jacob. And when you run from your problems, like Jacob does, something happens in you. Paranoia starts to set in. Right? Where maybe when you were talking to this person, you were aware that they hate you. Hey, Esau hated Jacob. But as you depart from this person, as you go away from this person or this situation or dynamic or whatever it is, paranoia starts to set in. And what you start to believe is you start to believe that everybody is against you. Everybody hates you. Everybody's against you. Nobody wants to make this thing work. No one wants to reconcile with you. And you will start having these feelings that people are gossiping about you or people are out to get you or something like that. Paranoia starts to set in. You see, when you flee one time, it's not like you could just stop running. You guys understand that? There's no distance you and I can travel to get away from our problems because the problem doesn't exist out here. The problem exists inside of you. And you guys are going to realize that. Whether you've realized it already or you're going to realize it one day, you're going to recognize very clearly you can't run from your problems. You can try, but it will catch up with you. And the question that you have to ask yourself is, when your problem catches up with you, are you going to continue to run or are you going to face it? Now, those people who choose to run their entire lives, they have very sad lives. They have very, very sad lives, and their paranoia and their paranoia and their maturity is completely, it doesn't exist. It doesn't exist. You look at certain people and they spend their entire lives running. Whenever a situation or relationship starts going sour, they just break it off and they move on. Whenever a job starts going sour, they quit and they move to a different one. Whenever a situation in their life starts turning sour, they can move. There are people that actually literally spend their entire lives moving around the country, around the world, trying to get away from problems that they've created. And they never learn how to confront. Now, this could be either, once again, it could be something that you've done, which is where Jacob's at, but it could also be a situation where something's been done to you and you also don't want to confront the problem. Right? Maybe someone hurt you, maybe someone violated you, and it's much easier just to cut that person off and say, I'm not going to deal with you anymore, than it is to actually communicate with them. This scenario speaks to me in my life quite a bit. Whenever something went sour in a relationship with me, I would just cut people off and run away from them. And by the way, when I talk to you guys about my friends in the Marine Corps, that's why I joined the Marines too. I just didn't want to deal with the problems inside of my life. I didn't want to deal with the stuff that happened in high school. I didn't want to deal with my family. I didn't want to deal with my friends. And so I fled. I ran away. And something happens inside of your brain when you start running because the way that I thought, my thought process was, is this is my opportunity to start a new life. I don't know if you guys have ever thought that way before. Maybe you're going to a new school or something like that, and you're like, I can now be the person I always wanted to be. You know, it was those people that were holding me back. It was these sour relationships. They were the ones that were making me act this way. And now I'm in a new situation. I could be a different person. But you know what you find out? no matter where you go, you're there. Right? There you are. And so I traveled across the country. I went over to North Carolina. I hung out with a group of people that were totally different than anyone I've hung out with before. And I became the same exact person, established the same exact reputation as before, and started making the same exact mistakes as I did before. You can't run away from your problems. You just can't do this. It's going to come back to haunt you. And after my time in the Marine Corps, God had me do something very similar to this. After my time in the Marine Corps, I wanted to go somewhere else. I was in this unique position after I got out of the Marines. It was really cool, where I had the GI Bill. I don't know if you guys know what that is. But when you get the GI Bill, you go to any college that you want, and anywhere you want, and it's paid for. Beyond them paying your full tuition, they actually give you money to live on top of it. So it's a really good deal. It's pretty awesome, actually. And so I had the whole country open to me. I was like, dude, I could move anywhere I want. And I had friends from all over the country. I had friends who lived in Hawaii. I had friends who lived in New York. I had friends who lived in Florida. I had friends who lived in California. You see what I mean? I could go anywhere I wanted to. And I felt God calling me back to Tucson. I was like, really? You know, cactus, the desert, the place that I ran away from, this is where you want me to come back to? And God said, yes, I want you to come back to Tucson, Arizona. So I ended up coming back here. And as awkward as it was and as difficult as it was, I thank God every day that I did come back here, that I listened to him. Because now when I look at my friends and I look at where they're at, they're still running. Most of them are still running. Most of them are still trying to get away from their problems. They're still trying to, pretty much all of them are divorced, by the way. They're all divorced because they never learned how to deal with the problems in their lives. They never learned how to work things out or to confront issues or to confront issues in themselves. They just know how to flee. They just know how to run away. And I can tell you guys this, there's no way I would be married today if God didn't deal with this issue in my life. Because in my dating relationship, I would like to tell you guys that I was perfect, and I didn't do anything wrong, but my wife will tell you otherwise. Right? I made a lot of mistakes in our dating relationship. I caused a lot of drama in our dating relationship. There were definitely times where we shouldn't have made it because of things that I had done. And if I didn't learn this lesson, if I didn't learn how to go to her and be like, hey, you know what, Emma, I was wrong. Whatever it takes to make this right, I want to do. As opposed to fleeing, there's no way I would be married. There's no way I'd be in the job that I'm in today. There's no way I'd have anything that I have today. But this is not an easy path to walk. So Jacob is in a place where he's panicking and he's wanting to run again. He's wanting to run again, but he knows he can't. He knows he literally has nowhere else to go. There's no one else is going to take him in. There's nowhere else he can run. He has to keep going. And so in verse 9, Jacob said, O God of my father Abraham and God of my father Isaac, the Lord who said to me, return to your country and to your family, and I will deal well with you. I am not worthy of the least of all the mercies of all the truth which you have shown your servant, for I have crossed over the Jordan with my staff, and now I have become two companies. Deliver me, I pray, from the hand of my brother and from the hand of Esau, for I fear him, lest he come and attack me and the mother with the children. For you said, I will surely treat you well and make your descendants as the sand of the sea, which cannot be numbered for the multitude. So he lodged that same night and took what came to his hand as a present for Esau, his brother. So Jacob, he goes before God and he prays to him. He says, God, I want you to protect me. I want you to protect me. I want you to take care of me. Because now, not only is Jacob realizing, and this is really cool because it does show that Jacob is growing up and he's realizing the consequences of his actions. Because if you notice in his prayer, he's not just concerned about him, he's concerned about who else? His family. He realizes, not only have I made my life a total wreck from the bad decisions I've made, but guess what? I've made my family a total wreck from the decisions I've made. And this is a good moment in his life. And it's a moment, like I said, that you guys are going to realize at some point. That you're going to realize, not only have I wrecked my own life through being a coward and through running and not being able to deal with my problems, but I've actually wrecked everyone who cares about me as a result. And you can start thinking about yourself as just like a virus. You're just like, man, I'm just a terrible person. Everyone that I go into their lives, I end up ruining, and you could end up feeling a lot like Jacob. But actually, this is a good moment in his life, and I'll explain why later. But the reason why we can know that Jacob just ain't there yet is notice what he does. He prays to God for help. He says, God, you need to protect me. But then immediately, he starts giving Esau gifts. So he starts sending him hundreds of cattle and stuff like that to try to buy him off. You know, you can really tell when someone is trusting God, when he's really trusting in God, is when they're done trying and they're just ready to rest. Right? Anxiety, if you ever wonder why anxiety, any of you guys struggle with anxiety, guilt, shame, things like that, all those emotions and all those feelings, they come from the delusion that you are in charge of your life, that you can fix things. You know, if you just sit there and you worry about it enough, you can make things right. You can make things happen. Now, don't get me wrong. There are some times where there's stuff that you can do and you need to do it in that particular instance. But in Jacob's situation, there is nothing he can do. There's nothing he can do. He needs forgiveness. You guys get that? He hasn't done anything right. He needs Esau to forgive him. And the only way that Esau is going to forgive Jacob is if God works inside of Esau's heart. And Jacob, instead of just trusting that, he is attempting to buy his forgiveness. He's attempting to buy the forgiveness of his brother. So does this show that he's really at the place where he's ready to deal? No, I mean, think about this. Think about what he's done to this guy. He's deceived him twice and taken away his birthright. That's a pretty hefty crime, you know, to think about. And now what is he doing? He's like, yeah, I know I screwed your life up, but here's a couple cattle, you know? We good, right? Here's some cows, you know? Some goats, some sheep. This makes everything better, right? It reminds me of a guy named Judas Iscariot. Right, Judas Iscariot, he betrayed Jesus for 30 pieces of silver. Now, to betray someone to death is a pretty hardcore crime, right? I mean, if you take one of your friends and you sell them out to the point where they're going to get murdered, that there's really nothing you can do to make that right. But you know what he tries to do? He tries to make it right. He realizes that he did something wrong, and instead of going to Jesus, instead of going to the person that he wronged and saying, like, Jesus, you know what? I was weak. I was stupid. I was foolish. I was wrong. I'm so sorry. Could you forgive me? Instead of doing that, he goes to the Pharisees, and he tries to give back the money. Say, take back the money. Take back the money and just take it back. You know, let's have a do-over. Pretend like none of this happened. Just let him go. And they're like, dude, are you kidding me? Like, we're not going to do that. You already betrayed him. It's already over. We're going to crucify him. And you know what Judas did after that? Killed himself. That's what happens when you come in encounter with a situation where you realize there is nothing I can do to make this right. And so your solution is, I should just kill myself. There's nothing I can do to make it right. There's nothing I can do to justify what I've done, so I'm just going to off myself. Right? That's the solution that he came to. He could either run away or he could kill himself. He killed himself. Jacob's going to make the right decision in the end, but he's at this point, he's just not ready to make it. He's not ready to simply trust God and realize what I need is forgiveness. I don't need to make things right. I need to just have somebody forgive me. And those of you guys who have been wronged, isn't that really what you want the person who wronged you to do? I mean, imagine if someone just ruined your reputation. They gossiped about you, ruined your reputation to all your friends and your little social group. And then they came up to you later and they're like, hey, here's $50. You know, I mean, you'd be like, well, thanks for the $50. But I mean, it doesn't make up for what you did to me. You know, lunch is on me, bro. You know, here's an Outback Steakhouse, you know, gift card. You know, we're good, though. Right. You know, like, dude, you don't want that. You want them to just come to you and be like, dude, I'm not going to offer you anything because nothing I can give you can make up for what I've done. Right. If they give you money, that cheapens the wrong that they've committed to you. If they give you a gift, that cheapens what they've done. That's like saying, I could buy back your forgiveness. You don't want that. You want them to just look you in the eyes and say, like, dude, I was wrong. Could you forgive me? You know, I know you shouldn't excuse me. I know you shouldn't. But I would just, you know, I please, could you forgive me for what I did to you? You know, that's what you would want from them, but that's not what people tend to do. And just think about it. If that's not what you want, what makes you think that's what other people want? If you've wronged them, you need to own up to what you've done. Don't try to buy it off. Don't try to do anything like that. You need to own up to what you've done. And when we own up to what we've done, the only person who could grant divine forgiveness is God. He's the only person that could do that. And this is why. It goes back to Laban a little bit. I'll explain this through Laban. When we forgive people, when I was a kid, I remember whenever something happened between me and my sister, my parents would, you know, because me and my sister used to fight all the time, and it got pretty radical. But anyway, you know, me and my parents, they would sit us down and be like, okay, you know, you guys need to apologize to each other. You know, Peter, say you're sorry. And I'd be like, sorry, you know, like, and she'd be like, okay, Becca, say you forgive him. And my sister would be like, I forgive you, you know, and it would be through gritted teeth, and it didn't mean anything, you know. And here's how you could really tell that it didn't mean anything. Because down the road, whenever we got into another fight, I would say something like, this is just like that time a year ago when you did this, and I bring up the past. You see, if you've really forgiven someone, why are you bringing up the past? Does that make sense? If you really let it go, why have you been stewing on it for a year? Don't say it. Now, in 1 Corinthians 13, it says this, love keeps no record of wrongs. That's what it says. This is a part of love. Love does not keep a record of things that have happened in the past that have been wrong. Love forgives, to put it another way. But that's not what we see in the real world, is it? That's not what we see in marriage. It's not what we see in married couples who've been married for 30 years, right? They get into a fight. And you know, in my time of marital counseling, it's funny to me. Because the fight is usually something stupid. It's usually like, you know, the husband forgot to flush the toilet, or, you know, he, like, you know, didn't take out the trash, or, you know, he clipped his fingernails on the bed, or, you know, something like that, where it's like it's gross, it's wrong, but, like, it turns into this massive, like, two-week fight where it, like, splits the marriage, and they're separated, and they're just, like, breathing fire on one another. Because it began with just, he clipped his fingernails on the bed again, that pig. But then it turned into, this is like everything else you do in the marriage. You never take my feelings into consideration. And it's just like 6 years ago when you forgot my birthday. And it's just, everything just starts just boiling up. And I'm like, wait, how did the fingernails turn into the birthday, turn into the, you know, forgetting, you know, like, how did this happen? You know, that it's bringing up everything. You know what it shows me? Did she ever really forgive him? No, there was no forgiveness there. And then the way the husband deals with it tells me this. He never actually asked for forgiveness. He just tried to make it up to her. So she's like, you forgot my birthday all these years ago. He's like, well, I got you flowers after that. It's like, okay, well, okay, that's great, but it doesn't make up for the fact that you forgot in the first place. You know, well, I cleaned up my fingernails. Well, it's okay, but did you ever apologize for the fact that you clipped them in the first place? That you were that insensitive in the first place? No, you just try to make up for it. So you see here that there's something broken in all of us where we don't know how to ask for forgiveness and we don't know how to give forgiveness. And this is the thing that the world will never understand. The only way to forgive is actually inside of the Bible, is actually God's way. The best you can do outside of God's way is you can forget things. You could repress memories. But I've dealt with a lot of people that have tried that method, and you know what I found out? You never really forget. You never really forget. You repress things and you try to forget them, but it always creeps back up inside your heart. There's always a memory of it. At best, I've run into people that have repressed things for so long that they're acting, their lives are a complete wreck, and they don't even know why their lives are a wreck. They're like, I don't even know why no relationship works out. And it's like, it's because they've buried their abuse and other things that have happened in the past. They've never dealt with it, and they just buried it and not thought about it. And because of that, their past is haunting them. They just don't even remember it. Only God could give you the power to forgive. Because this is what forgiveness is. Notice, remember what happened between Laban and Jacob. Why were they able to leave one another? Remember they set up the heap of rocks? And why did they set up the heap of rocks? What were they saying? They're like, dude, I can't watch over you. I can't control you, but who can? God. That is the only way that forgiveness could possibly happen, is if I know for a certainty that somebody's going to balance the books at the end. That's the only way I can truly forgive someone. Because if I let something go, quote unquote, am I not excusing their behavior? Am I not just allowing justice to go unmerited? Which is our fear in the first place, right? Of forgiving someone. like, dude, if I forgive them, they get away with it, you know? And so, I need to hold on to this forever. Okay, well, you could do that, but even if you hold on to it forever, it doesn't mean that they actually get what's coming to them. The only way you can genuinely forgive someone is if you know for a certainty that somebody is going to hold them accountable to what they've done. And if it ain't going to be you, it's got to be someone else. And I hate to tell you guys this, but I've seen a lot of wicked people get away with their wickedness their entire lives. They die in their wickedness, never having been confronted by what they've done. You know, they never have to deal with what they've done. They get away with it. And if there's no such thing as divine judgment, then they did get away with it. If God really doesn't hold people accountable, then that person really did get away with it. And you know what? You should stay bitter at them for the rest of your life. The only way you should truly, genuinely forgive someone is if there is some sort of a consequence that's going to happen to them. An actual consequence that's going to deal with the situation and not just give it up. I actually learned this lesson from a little kid once, which is weird. I was trying to counsel him, and he said something that really spoke to me. But anyway, there's a little five-year-old kid, and he was dealing with anger. And I was like, you know, what kind of things, like, really piss you off? You know, what really makes you angry? And he's like, I really hate it, you know, when my little brother, you know, he, like, goads me. I don't know if you guys who are older siblings know this tactic, right? The younger sibling will, like, mess with you. And what are they trying to do? They're trying to get you to respond, because then what can they do? They could tell on you, right? You know, like, so they goad you till you, like, smack them or something, and then they're like, Mom, you know, and then you get busted, and you're like, oh, you know? And so I was like, okay, so what really gets you? And then he says that. He says, you know, it's because my younger brother does this to me, and then I hit him, and then I get in trouble. I was like, okay, well, what have you been doing with your anger lately? And he's like, well, he's like, lately, whenever he messes with me, I just go tell my mom immediately. And I was like, really? I was like, why do you do that? And he's like, because I know that if I hit him, I'm just going to get in trouble for it. But I know if my mom hits him, then that's okay. So I was like, dude, that's actually really wise. You know, and that's essentially, that is exactly what the Bible tells us to do. The Bible tells us to tell God on the person that you're angry with. You know, let me give you an example of this. Of someone who does this. If you have your Bible, go to Psalm chapter 56. I'm going to show you. I quote this one a lot because it's one of my favorite ones. 58, sorry. 58. But we're going to be in verse 6. So David is dealing with people who he hates. And this is what he says about them. Break their teeth in their mouth, O God. Break out the fangs of the young lions, O Lord. Let them flow away as waters which run continually. When he bends his bow, let his arrows be as if cut in pieces. Let them be, this is my favorite one, let them be like a snail which melts away as it goes. Have you guys ever poured salt on a snail?
Oh, no.
It's kind of interesting. But anyway, awesome. It's kind of awesome. Yeah, I'd recommend it. No, after church. But that's what he's saying. He's like, I want this guy to melt like a snail that's eaten salt. You know, he's like, dude, this one's pretty gross. Like a stillborn child of a woman that they may not see the sun. Before your pots can feel the burning thorns, he shall take them away as with a whirlwind, as his living and burning wrath. The righteous shall see when he sees the vengeance. Notice this, he shall wash his feet in the blood of the wicked. Is that hardcore? Now remember, this is a psalm. This is their hymn book. Could you imagine if we sang this in church? We're like, you know, Tom's, you know, playing the bass, and ours just like, I want to wash my feet in the blood of my enemies. And we're all like, yeah, you know, we're like singing it. We're like, dude, this is awesome. You know, I can relate to that song. You know, like, I can't relate to the songs where they're like, I just forgive everyone who wrongs me. You're like, dude, nah, I don't really relate to that too much, you know. But the Psalm 58, I'm like, yeah, I get that. You know, I understand that one. And this is what David is doing. When he's writing the psalm, who is he talking to? Who's he talking to? He's talking to God. He's talking to God. He's not doing what we do. It's this neat little word that you might learn if you ever take psychology. It's called ruminating. You guys ever heard that word? Ruminating is where something happens. Maybe you get into a fight with your best friend, and you go home, and you're in your room alone, and you start thinking about that conversation over and over and over again, and you think about what you wish you would have said and how you wish it would have gone. That's called ruminating. That's not going to God. That's going to yourself and allowing your own anger and bitterness to just run wild in your head and your heart. That's what that is. And that doesn't provide healing. That provides further hurt. It's gonna hurt you. They've actually done studies and they've proven that ruminating like that actually causes a lot of damage to you physically. People who ruminate a lot struggle a lot more with anxiety, depression. They actually struggle with weight loss and stuff like that. It has a lot of consequences on you as a human being. They don't have a whole lot of peace in their lives. David is not doing that. David is literally going to God and he's expressing to him honestly the way he feels. That's what he's doing. That is why God is the only one who could grant forgiveness. He's the only one that could do that. So if I know that I've wronged someone, so if someone's wronged me, I need to ask God for forgiveness. I need to ask him. I need to say, God, you know what? You know, do it like the Psalms. If you like writing music, dude, write a poem, write a song about how much you hate that person, and dude, be as violent as you want, man, because I guarantee you're not going to be as violent as David. You know, I mean, that's pretty radical, you know, where he's talking about God smacking them in the face and knocking out their teeth and, you know, having them inside of a pot with burning thorns and, you know, washing his feet with their blood. I mean, that's pretty radical. I don't know. If you guys write stuff like that, that's fine too. But, you know, that's what he's thinking in his mind. That's what he's thinking justice is. So you go before God and you say, God, if I were you, this is what I do to this person. But if you read the end of that psalm, he says, yet I will trust your judgment. That's what forgiveness is. It's saying, God, this is what I would do if I were in your position, but I firmly trust that you're going to judge correctly. And the ultimate evidence that we as Christians have that God judges everything is the cross. Is the cross of Jesus Christ. That we look at the cross of Jesus Christ and that is our evidence that God judges all sin. He doesn't just look at certain things and be like, hey, I could just forgive that. I could just look over that. We have the only God that says, I must judge everything. And I'm so serious about that, I'm going to take my only son and I'm going to crucify him for the sins of the world. God takes every sin seriously. That's how we're able to trust God's judgment. That's how we deal with our anger. Now, that's how I deal with the anger I have towards people. But if I realize that I'm the problem, I need to pray that God would let that person forgive me. Because if God doesn't grant that person forgiveness, they can't forgive me. They may be able to verbalize to me, hey, bro, I forgive you. But then again, years later, they'll be like, and then that time you did this. And I'll be like, dude, you said you forgave me, you know? Well, they didn't really, right? The only person that could actually enable someone to forgive is God. So that means that when you wronged someone, it forces you to humble yourself before God and trust him. Because if God doesn't grant that person forgiveness, it just won't happen. One more thing that I'll mention before we move on to this really awesome part that happens. In the Proverbs, it says this, a brother offended is more difficult to win than a heavily guarded city. In Solomon's day, if you guys ever read this in history class, in Solomon's day, when they were taking a heavily guarded city, they would take it through the means of siege warfare. You guys ever studied that? You heard of that? Siege warfare was this interesting little tactic where you would camp your army outside of someone's city and you would just starve them out. And so you cut off their supply routes and you would starve them out for as long as it took. The siege of Rome took a couple years. The siege of Jerusalem took 5 years. Alexander the Great, when he did the siege of Tyre and Sidon, it took him 13 years, right? So siege warfare, you're in it for the long haul, right? You're not going to camp out there for a week and be like, oh, it didn't work, you know, and like walk away. You're in it for years. You see what Solomon's telling us? You see what the wisdom there is? When you wrong someone, you're in it for the long haul. You know, you can't just go to that person and be like, hey, my bad. We're good, right? You know, no, be ready for years of them dealing with that forgiveness before you. If you're really serious about making things right before that person, get ready for years. Don't just give that, you know, that small apology or whatever and just, you know, write them a letter, an email, or, you know, write it on their Facebook page, you know, hey, bro, my bad, you know, like, we're good, right? You know, how about a hug? You know, don't do that because don't expect them to just forgive you. It doesn't work that way. And don't be surprised when they do bring it up again. And you know what you should do if they bring it up again? What should you do? That's right. That's right, man.
Run them over
and go in reverse. How dare you bring it up again? You said you forgive me. Liar! You know, like, don't do that. What should you do? Ask for forgiveness again. Hey, man, you know what? You're right. What I did to you back then was really wrong. Could you forgive me? Say it again. And what that, it diffuses the whole situation. Because if someone, like, is bringing something up that happened a year ago and you're like, and you start defending yourself, that's when the argument gets really nasty. But if you just say, like, hey, you know what? That was wrong. You're right. You're absolutely right. Could you forgive me? What does that do? It puts it on who? It puts it on them. Now they have a choice. They can either forgive you or not. But if you defend yourself, you're never going to stop. You're never going to reach the place where you're going to stop defending yourself. It's going to be forever. Now, this is what happens to Jacob. He sends all those people over. He comes back with a report that, hey, by the way, Esau's still coming. And so he starts panicking even more. Verse 19, so he commanded the second and third and all who followed the drove, saying, in this manner you shall speak to Esau when you find him, and also say, behold, your servant Jacob is behind us. For he said, I will appease him with the present that goes before me, and afterward I will see his face. Perhaps he will accept me. So the present went on before him, and he himself lodged that night in the camp. And he arose that night, and took his two wives, his female servants, and his 11 sons, and crossed over the ford Jabbok. He took them and sent them over the brook, and sent over what he had. Then Jacob was left alone. So you see, Jacob can't sleep. When anxiety really starts to set in, you're not going to be able to sleep. You're going to be panicking. You're going to be thinking about ways out of it. How could I help this? How could I make this situation better? And Jacob comes to the conclusion. The only way that anyone's going to get out of this situation alive is if I go meet Esau alone. Right? I'm gonna send away my wife and my kids. They're going to go that way. I'm going to meet Esau alone. And at least then he'll just kill me, and maybe he'll let my family live. That was his solution at that point. Now, once again, that's close to the right thing at this point. He's really close to doing the right thing at this point, where he realizes, I want to take the consequences for my actions. No one else should suffer because of me, so I'm gonna be left alone. But you see what anxiety does to you. Anxiety isolates you, always. Because when you really get the anxiety steam going, nobody can help you. Even when people offer you viable solutions, you'd be like, hey, Peter, have you thought about doing this? You'd be like, no, that's not going to work. Well, have you tried it? It just won't work, all right? You know, and I just reject it. I just isolate from people. Because in my anxiety, even when I do things, it doesn't alleviate the anxiety. Because, again, anxiety comes from the delusion that you can control the world. And you can't. You can't control the world. You can't do it. So it's going to isolate. It's going to make you feel alone. No matter how many people love you in your life, You could have 100 people love you and care for you and say, dude, we're on your side. But if just one of your friends hates you, that one situation is going to overtake all of your emotions and anxieties. You're not going to be able to receive any love from anybody. And you're going to be alone, just like Jacob. And Jacob does exactly what we do. It says, and a man wrestled with him until the breaking day. This man, do you guys know who it was? It tells us at the end. It's God. God comes in flesh. Sounds a lot like who? Jesus, right? God comes in flesh, descends in flesh, comes. And when Jacob sees God, so he's praying all night, God, help me. Please help me. You know, give me a sign. Give me something. God shows up, and you know what his first reaction is? Tackles him, right? And he puts him in a headlock. He's like, dude, you're going to bless me. You know, and he starts fighting him, and that's exactly how we are. We pray to God, we ask God for help, but in the end, what we really want to do is we want to fight. We want to fight with God. We want someone to blame, to put it another way. Like, you know what? You know, this is your fault. You led me this way. You made this happen. You know, why can't you just bless me? You know, why can't you just make my life good? You know, what's wrong with you? And we start wrestling with God. And the beautiful thing about God is that if you want to wrestle with God, he's down to wrestle. You know, he's cool. You know, he could have just, like, you know, this... Yeah, he could have just, like, right when, you know, Jacob tried to tackle him, he could have just, you know, thrown him away, you know, like, you know, thrown him in the desert, you know, broken his arms, you know, like, blinded him. There's so many options he could have done. But he just lets Jacob wrestle him, which I think is hilarious. You know, he just, like, lets him tire himself out. And I've had so many nights like this with God, where I'll be praying to God. I'll be like, God, why don't you do something? And God, and there'll be no answer. And I'll cry out even louder, and God will just still not answer. And I just keep crying out all night, and God doesn't do anything. Well, he's just letting me tire myself out. You know, because God's trying to do something in us, and it's exactly what he's trying to do with Jacob. This is what happens. Let me read you the story so you guys can see what happens. What he's going to do to you. Be ready for it, because he's going to do it to you. He's done it to me. He's going to continue to do it to me. This is what he does. Verse 25. Now when he saw that he did not prevail against him, he touched the socket of his hip, and the socket of Jacob's hip was out of joint as he wrestled with him. Have any of you guys had a bone go out of joint before? It is pretty darn painful. It is just about the most painful thing that's ever happened to me. It's horrible. It's indescribable. It really is. It's indescribable, the amount of pain that it is. I've had my shoulder grow out of socket, and now it goes out of socket every now and then. It's absolutely miserable. But to have a socket go out of place, I mean, if your hip socket went out of place, do you think you could walk? Do you think you'd be able to walk? Heck no. You know, like maybe when you reinsert it, you'll be able to walk. He's going to have a limp for the rest of his life. As we go through this book, he has a limp for the rest of his life as a result of this. Beyond that, it actually says how he put his hip out of socket. It's not like he just dislocated. I mean, if you look at the hip bone's huge. It's like, how did he dislocate? It actually says that he hit his hip in such a way that it shriveled the muscle around it and dislocated it. So it's not just that it's dislocated. It's like the muscle around it is gone. You know, it's gone. And if you look at it, you know, a map of your anatomy or whatever, what actually holds your bones in socket is your muscles and your ligaments. That's what holds it in socket. And so if all the muscles and ligaments are dried up, it's not only is it out of socket, but it's going to be almost dang near impossible to keep it in socket. It's going to just keep dislocating all the time. So his ability to walk is done. His ability to run is done. His ability to do anything is done. And you see what God's done to Jacob? What could Jacob not do now? He physically can't run away. He can't flee anymore. And now Jacob is in a situation where he literally, if God doesn't save his life, he is screwed. You guys get that? If God doesn't do something, he's done. He has no more options. He has nothing to trade. He has nothing to barter. He has no one to blame. He has nothing to do. He can't run. He can't fight. He can't hide. All he can do is beg for help. And in this story, it kind of seems like Jacob, you know, when I ever read this story, it kind of seems like Jacob's kind of got the upper hand here. But when you really think about it, there's no way he can, because his hip socket's out of place. But, you know, it says that the man said, Jesus said, let me go for the day breaks. But he said, I will not let you go unless you bless me. So we get this idea that maybe Jacob's like, you know, got him in a headlock or something like that. And in Hosea 12, if you want to read, Hosea gives another version of the story where it says that Jacob sought a blessing with weeping and mourning. So it's not that Jacob's got him in a headlock. It's probably like Jesus is standing up straight, like trying to leave, and he's like hanging onto his leg, like, you know, like, don't go, you know, and Jesus is like dragging him down the floor, you know. It's like, yeah, let me go, bro. I got to get out. He's like, please, you know, like, but I won't let you go until you bless me. And he's like grabbing his leg. He's just refusing to let go. And this is the moment where Jacob has finally learned the lesson. And this is the lesson that we all need to learn. God is near to the broken. God gives aid to the broken. God gives aid to the people who realize that all they have is Jesus. Because until this moment, Jacob had schemes. Jacob had ways to get around stuff. This is the moment where he literally has no other option. And this is what God says to him. He says, what is your name? And Jacob said, Jacob. Now, what does the name Jacob mean?
Liar.
Liar, deceiver, heel catcher. One who gets his way through thievery and deception. That's what his name literally means. So God says, what's your name? He's like, deceiver. My name is deceiver, supplanter. That's my name. And he says, your name shall no longer be called Jacob or supplanter, but Israel. Now, Israel, there's a lot of different translations of what this means. Some translations say prince with God. Some translations say one who strives with God. Some translations say one who obeys God. Some translation says God will prevail. But this is what that name means, what it really is getting at. It's getting at someone who is no longer trying to get his own way, but it's getting at someone who wants whose way? God's way. Right? That's what the name is really saying. So whenever you look at Israel on a map, now you know why it's called Israel. It did become Israel because God's like, you know, I'm going to name you Israel because you guys are awesome. And Israel means awesome, you know, and that you guys are going to be the awesome nation forever. Israel literally means it's this story. It comes from this story of somebody who was broken, crying, weeping, had no other options but to trust God. That's the story of Israel. And in the New Testament, do you guys know that we're called spiritual Israel? That we're now Israel before God? Now, if you want to be the Israel before God, you have to be broken. You have to recognize that there's no one that could help you except for God. Jesus, over and over again during his earthly ministry, he yelled at the Pharisees and the scribes and all those people because in their hearts they thought that they can help themselves before God. And you know who Jesus hung out with? Prostitutes, thieves, liars, alcoholics. That's who he hung out with. You know why? Dude, because a prostitute knows that she can't help herself before God. I go to the Salvation Army every week with Bo. These are dudes who are so into their addictions that they are just their lives are completely ruined. They have nothing left. They were living on the streets. You know, when I talk to them, not a single one of them raises their hand. They're just like, hey, man, like, I think I'm good before God. I think God, like, loves me just as I am because of what I've done, you know, because I've lived such a righteous life. You know, I've ruined my family. I've abused my kids. You know, I've totally given my life up on meth, you know. But I think God really loves me the way I am. You know, I think that I'm really one with him because of the things that I've done. That person's like, dude, I'm broken. I need grace. I need mercy. God needs to have mercy on my soul or else I'm done. But when I go to people who are in the church, so many people in the church believe that they're okay before God because of what they've done. And people who think that they're okay before God because of what they've done don't receive mercy. They don't receive mercy. They don't. That's why Jesus, he stood up, by the way, in church. He was in church. And he stood up and he said, whores and tax collectors are going to go to heaven and not you. Wouldn't that be radical if Scott stood up one day and said that? He said, dude, I was over on, south of 6 hanging out with some prostitutes. And I think they got a pretty good chance of going to heaven. Not so sure about your guys, you know, but they're good though. You guys, we'd be like, what? You know, the prostitute, the alcoholic, the meth addict, they're going to go to heaven? That's insane. How could they possibly go to heaven? Because the prostitute knows that she needs what? Mercy. You see, the other parable that I could give you guys that's in the Bible, it talks about a Pharisee and a tax collector. And they all go before God and says, the Pharisee prayed thus with himself. And he said, God, you know, thank God that I'm not like other men, you know, like this tax collector over here. And he starts talking about all of his, you know, his resume before the Lord of why he should be saved. And it says, then the tax collector came before God and he says, God, be merciful to me, a sinner. And Jesus says, that dude went home justified. The Pharisee, not so much. See, our relationship with God, I hope you guys get this. I hope you guys grab this. Your relationship with God is based on your weakness and your brokenness, not on your strength. If you want help, you have to admit to brokenness, which is why church is so bad. It's so weird to me that when I talk to people, I'm like, hey, how you doing? And everyone's like, dude, I'm doing great. I just want to look at them and be like, dude, you know this is a hospital, right? Like Jesus literally said, I didn't come for well people. I came for sick. Like, you know, this is a hospital. You know that the only people who are supposed to be here are broken people. Like, that's who's supposed to be here right now. It'd be like if I went to the hospital and I was like, hey, man, like, why are you here? They're just like, I just love the hospital. I'm so healthy that I wanted to go to the hospital to become more healthy. The food here is amazing. You know, I get free cable and, you know, it's awesome. You know, and these beds are so comfy. You know, they give you a menu and, dude, I got this sweet gown that, you know, it doesn't lock in the back, and I love it here, you know. Nobody says that. When you're in the hospital, you're there because you're sick. If you're in church, you're here because you're sick. You're here because you're a mess. That's why you're here. If you don't think you're a mess, you're in the same category as the scribes and the Pharisees. The only people who receive grace are the ones who know that they need it. People who don't think they need it are not going to get it. They're just not going to get it. Jacob finally comes to the place where he's ready to listen to God, where he's finally ready to trust God. And in my life, God has brought me to this place more times than I can tell you. He's brought me to this place in relationships. He's brought me to this place in fighting my own sin. And every sin that I've fought, I've come to this place multiple times. Because I thought I could conquer my sin on my own, and I failed so hard that I needed God to show me that I can't do it. He's brought me to this place when it comes to my job. He's brought me everything in my life, God has brought me to this place, because until I would become broken, there's no way I could become healthy. And I know for a fact, there are so many areas in my life that I need to come to this place, and I'm just not ready yet. And he's going to bring me there. It's going to be a long journey, but he's going to bring me there, and it's going to be painful, but it's going to be worth it. I'm not going to read chapter 33, you guys. I encourage you to read it on your own time. But what ends up happening is Esau meets Jacob, and he says to him, like, dude, like, I love you, man. I forgive you. Like, it's all fine. And Jacob's like, dude, that's crazy. I've been stressed out, and my hip got dislocated because I was afraid of meeting you, and this whole time you'd forgive me. That's nuts. And Esau's like, let's hang out. But Jacob is still not ready to deal. At the end of chapter 33, you'd think, like, dude, he's got it. You know, he's got it. He's going to do it. But he doesn't go home with Esau. You know why he doesn't go home with Esau? Who is Jacob offended? He's offended Esau, but who else did he offend?
Dad.
His dad. He's not ready to face his dad. And so he runs. He keeps running. And chapter 34 is radical. I'm going to go over it next service. I encourage you guys to read it on your own time. It is one of the most radical sections of Scripture that there is, though. You know, spoiler alert, I'm pretty sure more people die in this chapter than in John Wick. You know, like I don't know about that. You know, I don't know about that. It's tough, but you know, anyway, let's pray. And then we got a last song of praise. Dear God, I want to thank you so much for this gift of brokenness, Lord. I pray that we would learn to embrace it in our own lives, that we would learn to own up to the things that we've done, that we learn how to confront people that we've wronged. And in your name, amen.